Welcome back. This is Kathy with part two of the news from the Decatur area, both from the Decatur Herald and Review and possibly the Decatur Tribune if we have time. This particular article is in section D under Life, and the headline reads, Blue Connection Show, Part of a National Homeless Event, by Donette Beckett. Pamela Hauser was complaining about her hotel bed during a visit to New York City. Later that day, she walked onto the streets of the city to find a homeless man sleeping on a rock. She took his picture. It spoke to me so much, she said. Soon afterwards, Hauser began observing homeless people and created an exhibit devoted to bringing attention to the country's problem. Throughout November, the Blue Connection will present Hauser's exhibit, Someone's Family, beginning with the After 5 Live at 5 p.m. Friday, November 6th, in the gallery and retail shop. The Decatur exhibit will display 46 black and white images of documentary photos. They are capturing life as it exists in reality, says Millikan University instructor Britton Traubar. The photos were taken during Hauser's travels throughout the country, including Seattle, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. It is just a little speckling, she said. I've traveled a lot. Hauser does all of the processing and creating herself. That way I keep the costs down, she said. During the monthly exhibit, Hauser will give half of her proceeds towards local homeless shelters. I like to give back to the community, she said. Every little bit helps. The exhibit is part of Millikan University's contribution to National Hunger and Homeless Awareness Week from November 14th through the 22nd. Students will kick off the week on November 13th with Box City, in which they will spend an evening sleeping in boxes typical of a homeless environment. The documentary Home Stretch will be shown at 7 p.m. Thursday, November 19th at the Avon Theater. A film crew followed three teens with their struggles of being homeless in Chicago. The screening is sponsored by the Macon County Continuum of Care through Dove Incorporated. Hauser will be available to answer questions at the movie screening to discuss her experiences photographing homeless communities. During the Blue Connection exhibit, questions can be answered by Mary Garrison, Millikan University Associate Professor of Social Work. Her work has focused on social issues, poverty, and homelessness. Free tickets for the documentary can be obtained by contacting mgarrison@millikan.edu or by calling 424-5074. October 30th, Buzz. There's a percussion party. Millikan's percussion ensembles perform a pair of concerts in celebration of Halloween tonight. The all-age family-friendly event takes place in Schilling Hall's Albert Taylor Theater on the campus of Millikan University. Guests are invited to join the ensemble in costume. Best costume prizes will be awarded. Showtimes are at 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. today. Tickets are $8 and may be purchased at the Kirkland Fine Arts Center ticket office by phone at 424-6318 or online at kirklandfinearts.com. And in Peoria, Straight No Chaser plays the Peoria Civic Center at 8 p.m. Saturday, October 31st. Tickets are $49.50, $39.50, and $32.50. Judas Priest plays the venue at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, November 3rd. Tickets are $99.50, $69.50, $49.50, $39.50, and $29.50. Comedian Frank Caliendo plays at 8 p.m. Thursday, November 5th. Tickets are $48.75 and $38.75. Tickets are available at the box office and via Ticketmaster. At the Canopy Club in Champaign, I'm Schmacked plays Urbana's Canopy Club tonight. Tickets for the 10 p.m. show are $31, $26, and $21. GUR plays the venue at 9 p.m. Monday, November 2nd. Tickets are $20 in advance, $25 at the door. Tickets are available at canopyclub.com. At the Krannert Center, French clarinetist Raphael Sevier performs at Urbana's Krannert Center at 3 p.m. Sunday, November 1st. Tickets are $47, $15 for students, and $10 for youth. The Bollywood Masala Orchestra and Dancers of India performs Spirit of India at the venue Tuesday, November 3rd. Tickets for the 7:30 p.m. show are $34, $15 for students and $10 for youth. SOMI, the Lagos Music Salon, is presented Thursday, November 5th through Saturday, November 7th. Showtimes are 7:30 p.m. November 5th and 7 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. November 6th and 7th. Tickets are $42, $15 for students and $10 for youth. Tickets are available at www.krannertcenter.com. Young the Giant. Young the Giant performs two shows at Urbana's Canopy Club next week. Shows are 7 p.m. Wednesday, November 4th, and 8 p.m. Thursday, November 5th. Tickets are $26 and are available at canopyclub.com. At the Limelight, J.J. Gray and Mofro perform Thursday, November 5th at Peoria's Limelight Eventplex. Tickets for the 7 p.m. show are $25 and $20 and are available at limelighteventplex.com. Boondocks Pub Shows. 1,000 Horses plays Boondocks Pub in Springfield tonight. Tickets for the 10 p.m. show are $15. Maddie and Tay play the venue Thursday, November 5th. Tickets for the 10 p.m. show are $20. Tickets are available at www.boondockspub.com. And now I'll turn to the obituaries for the area. From Decatur, Max E. Pritz, 90, of Decatur, passed away at 6:04 a.m. on Wednesday, October 28th. A service to celebrate Max's life will be held at 10 a.m. on Monday, November 2nd, at the First Christian Church, 3350 North MacArthur Road, Decatur. The family will receive friends for a time of visitation from 4 to 6 p.m. on Sunday at the church. Max will be laid to rest in Macon County Memorial Park Cemetery with military rites provided by the Macon County Honor Guard. Dawson and Wyckoff North Chapel is assisting the family with arrangements. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be directed to the First Christian Church Arts Academy due to Max's love of the fine arts and children's ministry. Buckley, Dan Buckley, 60, died October 16th at his home in Santa Rosa, California. The cause was cholangiocarcinoma. Dan chose a quite simple life but loved life and lived it fully. He was preceded in death by his parents and is survived by his siblings. Memorial and tribute to Dan's life will be held at a later date. Donations may be made in honor of Dan to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital at www.stjude.org. Mabel Irene Evans, 91, of Shelbyville, Indiana, Illinois, died at 6:25 p.m. Wednesday, October 28th, in Shelbyville Manor. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Sunday, November 1st, in the First Church of the Nazarene of Shelbyville, Illinois, with Reverend Greg Breeden and Reverend Bob Turner officiating. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Saturday in the church. Burial will be in the Glenwood Cemetery, Shelbyville, Illinois. Arrangements are by Howe and Yockey Funeral Home, Shelbyville, Illinois, and may be given to the First Church of the Nazarene or the Saving Orphan Animals. Another Evans, Richard W. Evans, passed away peacefully Tuesday, October 27th, at his home, holding his wife's hand. Memorial services will be held Saturday, October 31st, at 10:30 a.m. at the Evangelical United Church of Christ in Godfrey, Illinois, with full military honors by the VFW Post 1308. Reverend Jerry McCaskey will officiate. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made in memory of Richard Evans to the community-supported gardens at La Vista Farms at 4350 Levis Lane in Godfrey, Illinois. Richard and Rosemary spent many afternoons volunteering at La Vista Farms. She pulled the weeds while he supervised. Ghent Funeral Home in Alton is in charge of arrangements. Melvin Clyde Lozier, 89, of Decatur, passed away Wednesday, October 28th, in Heartland of Decatur. Graveside services to celebrate Melvin's life will be at 1 p.m. Monday, November 2nd, at the Graceland Cemetery. The family of Melvin Clyde Lozier is being served by the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home, 2091 North Oakland Avenue, in Decatur. Katie Marie Yoder Miller, 67, of Lovington, Illinois, passed away at 9:26 on Wednesday, October the 28th, at her residence in rural Lovington, Illinois. Visitation will be held any time after 1 p.m. on Thursday, October 29th, at the family residence, 1352 State Highway 133, Lovington. Funeral service will be held at 9 a.m. on Saturday, October 31st, at the family residence. Bishop David E. Schrock will officiate. Burial will be in the Otto Cemetery in Arthur, Illinois. The Edwards Funeral Home is assisting with the arrangements. Roy Dean Gould, age 74, of Mattoon, Illinois, passed away at 3:20 p.m. on Tuesday, October 27th, at the Mattoon Health Care and Rehab Center. A celebration honoring his life will begin at 12 p.m. on Friday, October 30th, at the Schilling Funeral Home on Charleston Avenue in Mattoon, with Reverend Leonard Bauer officiating. Burial will follow at the Pleasant Grove Baptist Cemetery in Cook's Mills. Visitation for family and friends will be from 10 a.m. until the time of service at the funeral home on Friday. In lieu of flowers, donations in his honor may be given to Pleasant Grove Baptist Church on Cook's Mills Road in Humboldt, Illinois, Greater Champaign County, Ambucks in Urbana, or the Tri-County RC Club, 302 North Scott in Sullivan. Lynn Cezada, 74, Beecher City, passed away Wednesday, October 28th at St. John Hospital in Springfield. Surviving are his wife, son Edward Allen Cezada, and granddaughter Courtney Cezada. Memorials may be made to the donor's choice. Graveside service will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, October 30th at Ransom Cemetery in Beecher City. And since a lot of state sports titles are in the offing, I'll pick up on some sports news. Hearts cooled off in title game by Alex McNamee. Effingham became one of the hottest teams in the area, beginning with its win against Mount Zion on October 13th. The Hearts rattled off 10 straight wins starting that night, including 5 to win a tournament at Albion Edwards County 4 days later. They beat Monticello in a Class 3A Eisenhower Regional semifinal on Tuesday, and Muhammad Seymour dismissed Mount Zion, considered the favorite. Their chances of capturing the first regional title since 2008 look good. But Muhammad, who joins the Apollo in 2017, was there Thursday to spoil the week for a second future conference opponent. The Bulldogs won 25-20 and 25-21. I don't think we had a lesser of two enemies, Effingham coach Mindy Boswell said. Watching them play Mount Zion, they just never gave up. You never see any worry on their face. They're constantly in the game. They're so aggressive and scrappy that they can just come out of nowhere. They just don't die. Chandler Ramey had 8 kills, though only started to get on a roll in the second set when the Hearts were playing catch-up. Shelby Nunnemaker, who proved to be one of the most dominating middles in the area this year, and especially during the winning streak, was quiet with 4 kills and 1 block. We've got games where we look like we're one of the better blocking teams around, and there's games where they're using our block, Boswell said. Our second best blocker would be Chandler, and that's on the right side, but they didn't hit very much on the right side. The Hearts, 24-13, were chasing all night, except when they rallied from 9-7 down to take a 12-11 lead in the first set. They led 18-15 a few points later, but Muhammad scored 10 of the last 12 points to steal the game. They fell behind quickly in the second set, rallied within 5, then 4, then trailed only 21-18 late, but never could keep a streak growing. Since we played Mount Zion 2 weeks ago, we've been rallying from behind, Boswell said. Our sense of urgency was there. I've learned that these girls have a lot of fight, but they're scoreboard watchers too, so when they see we're down so much, we kind of lose everything. Boswell called timeouts, down 9-5 and 15-9, trying to spark something with the team, but Muhammad wouldn't budge. The Bulldogs beat MacArthur on Monday, came back Tuesday, and beat Mount Zion, then finished the job Thursday to win its first regional since 1996. I really don't give the girls a game plan. I think that'd just scare them a little bit, Muhammad coach Chandra Steers said. I just tell them to go out there and play. They finally just relax and are doing their thing. I couldn't have asked for a better week. This next article says Price was right. Brandon Price's phone lit up with a text from Coach Mike Popovich. Popovich and his Mount Zion coaching staff went right back to the drawing board, literally off the bus and into their office immediately after returning from Taylorville on September 25th. The Braves were rocked by a 31-6 loss. They put everything on the table, including the status of quarterback J.J. Aldridge. Price, then a wide receiver, quickly knew which way that was going. Later that night, he texted me about it and said I'd get about 50% of the reps, Price said. Then he brought me and J.J. in at the same time on Monday, and we talked about it. It was hard to get me the ball that game, actually. I was honestly pretty excited. By Monday, 50% turned into close to 100%. Price was the new starting quarterback for the Charleston game. In 4 games at quarterback, Price is 63 of 89 for 820 yards and 8 touchdowns. Running, he has gained 476 yards and scored 8 more times. We did it with a few select plays at the beginning and kept adding every week, Price said. We've put everything in now. Price and the Braves, 6-3, get to show Taylorville 9-0 what kind of team they've become with a new quarterback. The Apollo rivals meet for a rematch at 7 p.m. today in Taylorville in the first round of the Class 4A playoffs. Very rarely do you get another opportunity, Popovich said. In other sports, you're playing some home and away and run into them in a tournament at Christmas. You have a lot of different shots. That's not the case in football. The Braves are 3-1 since they made the change at quarterback. suffering back-to-back losses leading up to the decision. Price, who hadn't played quarterback since he was a freshman, filled in fine. "It was just natural," Price said. "I know it's been 2 years, but it felt like freshman year because a lot of my freshman teammates are on the line blocking and are my receivers." Now Taylorville and coach Jeb Odom are faced with preparing for a new quarterback, but Odom feels comfortable. "Watching Mount Zion on film this year reminds us about how teams probably looked at us on tape with Tanner Champley at quarterback," Odom said. "The run game goes through the Price and they pass a little bit." "We definitely thought it could be a possibility," Odom added, speaking about the change. "You only get athletes like him so much. It only makes sense to put him at quarterback to have the ball in his hands every time. That's how we were last year with Tanner back there." Mount Zion also made moves to put more of its best athletes in important positions. They started the season making an effort to play 22 kids, no one going both ways, but that had to change after the Taylorville loss. Mike Wicke plays outside linebacker and running back. Andrew Auten is lining up at right guard and middle linebacker. Nate Ewing is on both lines at left tackle and defensive end. Popovich said more play both sides of the ball today since Taylorville is the team that forced the change. The Braves also recently returned left guard Cody Emberton and Griffin Gallwiler from injuries. Emberton, a 3-year starter, is the heart of the Braves' offensive line. Gallwiler had 4 interceptions in 2 games before getting injured during week 2. "The change was good, was well needed," Emberton said. "Since then, everything's gone a lot smoother." Storm not taking chances in rematch by Aaron Dow. After a practice showered with rain, Sangamon Valley coach Michael Lee wasn't done. He took lineman Matt Standish aside, and the two practiced blocking punts again and again. Soaked and wind-whipped, Standish obliged by diving after Lee's kicks. "You never know if you'll need it," Lee said. That's the approach Sangamon Valley took this week. Lee budgeted time for extra reps working on punt blocking, and little weather wasn't going to get in the way. And even though Sangamon Valley landed a rematch with Sarah Gordo-Bement for the first week of the playoffs, he's not deviating from the scheduled playoff preparation either. This was supposed to happen far less, 2 conference teams matching up in the first round. After the IHSA did away with quadrants and went to seeding north and south brackets 1-16, but the math worked out that the 8-1 Storm and the 5-4 Broncos would rematch after Sangamon Valley won 41-25 in Week 5. "I would prefer to play someone new, just for the excitement factor," Lee said. "I guess the familiarity is both good and bad. You know what they're going to do, but in the back of my mind, it's, are they going to get tricky?" CGB coach Andy Curley is of the same mindset, although there's one thing he's happy to have. "It's a matchup that we're familiar with. It's a matchup the kids think we didn't play our best the first time around," he said. "You don't get the opportunity a lot in football to fix it. But I don't necessarily know if we would rather play them than somebody new. Part of it is not wanting to knock out a conference foe. Part of it is the playoffs can bring an exciting unknown. There's another angle for Sangamon Valley team still looking to build its legacy, not wanting the well you've already beat them argument to come up." "Playing some old people, it kind of gets old," Storm running back Wyatt Royce said. "We already beat CGB. If we play someone new and beat them, it kind of gets our school name out there. There's one new element for the Storm, playing at home. Last year's comeback season featured a rarity in 2 straight road games. Tonight's game will be the first home playoffs game since 2007. Lee's hoping with a scarcity of games tonight, Niantic will become a hot spot. I think it's going to be crazy," Royce said. "It's something where if you have a home game, you don't expect many people to be there. But since this is the playoffs, it's a bigger deal and you're going to expect a lot more people." The Broncos fans making the 40-minute drive will see a coach in Curley that's determined not to make the same mistake twice. There were a handful of things that went wrong, including multiple turnovers, including Dalton Groller's only lost fumble of the year, while he felt it was one of Sangamon Valley's best performances of the year. "It was one of those games where right as soon as you're done, it's, I'd like to do that over again," Curley said. "We walked out of there like Denny Green. They are who we thought they were." The Storm's rushing attack was slightly different than what they had seen on film as well. "They'd run some option in the past, but it had been more veer," Curley said. "They changed it up a little and ran more midline. There's not a whole lot of drastic difference. In the first half, they hit us with it a couple of times, and we weren't ready. Knowing both were going to be in 2A, they've been keeping tabs on each other. I'm pretty sure they followed us in the schedule," Lee said. "I'm pretty sure they have every game film other than weeks 1 and 2. Lee's made tweaks as well, simplifying the defensive back's reads after CGB threatened with the passing game late in the first half. One thing is the same. Lee wants to keep Groller and the rest of the Broncos' offense under control. We've done a good job of keeping their running attack to manageable plays, Lee said. They're good at what they do, so not giving them the big play is the big focus for us. Whether Sangam and Valley can turn out the same outcome in the sequel remains to be seen. Until then, there's certainly plenty of hype and noise sure to circle around Sangamon Valley's field, and like player, like coach, Storm running back Wyatt Beals is focusing on 7 o'clock tonight. I usually don't try to pay attention to all that outside the game. No matter how many people are here, we're going to play our hearts out, he said. You never know which game is going to be your last. Note, Curley said lineman Tyler Walker, who missed last week's game against Marrow Forsyth with a concussion, would be questionable to play today. Rams take title to advance. Toledo. After being on the doorstep of a regional championship for the last 4 years, Shelbyville captured its first since 2010 by beating Totopolis 25-20 and 25-15 on Thursday. Their reward, a home sectional. We have had some really good teams, but we have just run into teams that were also having really, really good years, Shelbyville coach Lisa Pfeiffer said. Getting our own sectional is huge and definitely a bonus for us. Shelbyville senior Kelsey Darnell, who served the final 4 points, said, "We've been working hard for it. It has taken a while, but we finally have done it." 2 long point streaks in the second set helped the Rams close it out. They went from down 4-3 up 12-6. Then they turned a 14-all tie into a 20-14 lead. Ryan Ambrose, 6 kills, led each 3 other attackers who finished with at least 4 kills. Courtney Williams came up big with 4 aces, 10 assists, and 8 digs. And Maddie Holland had 2 blocks. The Rams, 34-3, will play Piazza Southwestern at 6 p.m. Tuesday at home. And now turning to the Decatur Tribune, let's see what's going on there. From the City Beat by Paul Osborne, Lost Story, City Council approves development of New Hampton Inn Hotel on the city's southeast side. Last week's City Council vote in favor of a redevelopment with Evergreen Hospitality, LLC, for a New Hampton Inn Hotel on the city's southeast side hardly got any attention due to the controversial vote on whether to rezone Route 51 and Ash Avenue for a new Aldi store. As reported last week, the new Aldi rezoning issue failed to pass City Council by a 4-3 vote. However, during the same meeting, council members voted 4-2 with one abstention to approve the New Hampton Inn project. Councilman Chris Funk abstained from voting since the bank where he works does business with Evergreen Hospitality. Voting against the project were Councilman Bill Faber and Pat McDaniel. As part of the agreement, the city will share 50% of the hotel use tax collected over the next 5 years with the developer, which plans to invest more than $7 million to construct a new 4-story, 80-room hotel. The project will employ some 110 temporary construction workers and add over 30 jobs once it is completed. I asked McDaniel why he voted against the project since it would be bringing new jobs to the area. I'm all for economic development, and I do appreciate what Evergreen Hospitality, LLC, has been and is doing in Decatur, said McDaniel, who added that he felt sharing 50% of the hotel use tax with the developer was unfair to businesses that are already in Decatur and not getting the same incentives. Although some cities are in a position to not use incentives to attract new development, Decatur is not now in a position to eliminate such measures. For now, the only way for Decatur to attract new development is through incentives, which in turn can help the community grow through creating more jobs and adding more revenue. Although letting a developer keep 50% of the hotel use tax for a period of time isn't ideal, 50% is better than offering no incentive and having 0%. Besides, after 5 years, the incentive expires. Councilman Bill Faber has a letter to the editor elsewhere on this page about his failed attempt to get the City Council to agree on a study session regarding the minimum wage, stating, "As you know, I failed in my effort to persuade my colleagues to hold a study session, although Councilman McDaniel courteously seconded my request." If you are a councilman elected on a commitment to introduce measures, there is not anything wrong in trying to do what you said you would do if elected. However, there is no guarantee the rest of the council will share your view or even want to hold a study session about it. Unless you can get council members to agree on a study session for what you're advocating, there won't be any formal vote or forward movement on the issue. The Decatur Library Board of Trustees responded late last week to Mayor Julie Moore Wolf's request for the title to the library building at 130 North Franklin Street. Moore Wolf had written earlier, "Decatur residents have paid for this building through taxes and contributions through your fundraising efforts. The library is a valuable asset to this community. The city is committed to ensuring that the library is maintained and preserved so that it can continue to provide service and enjoyment for our citizens both now and in the future. John Phillips, president of the library board, gave the city the board's answer to the mayor's letter, writing in part, "The Library Board of Trustees would consider transferring the property in question under the same or similar terms as the proposed agreement between the Decatur Public Library and the Public Building Commission." My translation, after stripping away all of the niceties of the letter, "If you want the title to the library building, you can pay $3.5 million under the same deal we already almost have." Let me take a wild guess. I don't think that's what the mayor had in mind. It does seem a little strange. $3.5 million for a building the city has poured a lot of money into over the years and still owes over $700,000 in loans for upgrades? As I indicated in last week's column, this is not going to be pretty. Check out my Osborne Online column on the questionable closed meeting and vote of the board in reaching its decision. Thanks, Gail. Elsewhere in this edition, there is a story about Richland Community College's Dr. Gail Saunders announcing her resignation effective in the spring of 2016. I've known Gail about all of the years since she was hired to be the RCC president in 2001, and it was my privilege to work with her on some projects such as bringing the Farm Progress Show to Decatur during the years I was mayor. Gail certainly is an exceptional leader and a person who has worked very effectively, not only for RCC but for our area. Someone told me that it was going to be difficult to fill her shoes. I think they'd better get a new pair of shoes for the next president. Although I certainly wish the next president the best in my eyes, no one can fill her shoes. The very best wishes to Gail and her family. News from here and there. The Decatur Police Department is cracking down on drunk drivers. This Halloween, the Decatur Police Department is cracking down on impaired drivers with an aggressive drive sober or get pulled over enforcement effort, and is giving a fair warning to all partygoers: keep the party off the road. Driving while alcohol or drug impaired is deadly. It is illegal, and it will get you pulled over and arrested this Halloween, said Sergeant Chris Peters. If you want to stay safe and out of jail this Halloween, make a plan to get home without driving if you're impaired. According to the National Highway Safety Traffic Administration, nationally, 43% of all people killed in motor vehicle crashes on Halloween night from 6 p.m. October 31st to 5:59 a.m. November 1st from 2009 to 2013 were in crashes involving a drunk driver. On Halloween night alone, 119 people lost their lives during that same period. Children out trick-or-treating and the parents or others accompanying them are also at risk, as 19% of fatal pedestrian crashes on Halloween night involve drunk drivers. In every state, it's illegal to drive with a blood alcohol content of 0.08 or higher. In 2013, 10,076 people were killed in drunk driving crashes involving at least one driver with a blood alcohol content of 0.08 or above in the United States. Even if you drive impaired and aren't killed or seriously injured, you could end up paying as much as $18,000 for a DUI. The Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over enforcement campaign works to keep us all safe on the road and urges everyone to follow these simple tips. Plan a safe way to get home before you attend the party. Designate a sober driver, take public transportation, a car service, or call a sober friend or family member to get home. Walking while impaired can be just as dangerous as driving impaired. Designate a sober friend to walk you home. Use your community's sober ride program. If you see an impaired driver on the road, contact law enforcement as soon as it's safe to do so. If you see someone you think is about to drive while impaired, take their keys and help them get home safely. The law enforcement crackdown is funded by federal safety funds through the Illinois Department of Transportation. And a Red Cross reminder: Daylight Savings Time ends this weekend, and when everyone turns their clocks back, the American Red Cross reminds them to also take these steps to make sure their household is prepared for emergencies. They're recommending that you check your smoke detectors and replace your batteries, whether they're beeping at you or not. And that's all for today. This is Kathy signing off. You have a nice weekend, and we'll talk to you on Monday.